This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Welcome to the Rerooted Podcast with Francesca Maxime, trauma-sensitive mindfulness meditation teacher and poet. Together, we'll take a closer look at approaches to transforming trauma with insights from psychology, neuroscience, spirituality, social justice, and the creative arts. Join Francesca and her guests for an exploration of our shared connection and how we can cultivate greater compassion for ourselves and for others. If you'd like to support Francesca and the Rerooted Podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Francesca.
Hi, everyone. I'm Francesca Maxime, and welcome to the Rerooted Podcast here on Ram Dass's Be Here Now Network. We are recording today, the 25th of January, 2021. We have just inaugurated the 46th President of the United States. We are in the middle of winter here in the Northeast. I'm situated on Nipmuc territory here in Massachusetts at the moment, although I reside in Canarsie land in what is now commonly known as New York, in New York City and Brooklyn. I'm here because, as many of you know, in Rerooted, we explore what is it that makes us rooted to the land, to the earth, tethered to that which is all my relations all around us, and that which separates us, that which is part of what we feel as though there is sort of a spiritual and existential separation often within us, and also what is often what creates conflicts out in the world. And the goal of some of these conversations is to try and see, how did these come into being? Sometimes we use a mindfulness lens, a spiritual lens. Sometimes we use a historical lens. And that's kind of what I'd like to do today, is have a conversation with Dr. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. She grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a tenant farmer and a mother who worked. She's been active in the international indigenous movement for more than four decades and is known for her lifelong commitment to national and international social justice issues. Dr. Dunbar-Ortiz is a historian, the author of several books, and she is the editor of, seven books, actually, Living in San Francisco, An Indigenous People's History of the United States is the book that captured my attention, and it is the winner of the 2015 American Book Award. Dr. Dunbar-Ortiz, it's a pleasure to welcome you on the Rerooted Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Francesca. It's a pleasure.
Dr. Dunbar-Ortiz, one of the things that really amazes me about your work is you have had a lifelong commitment to this work. You've written many books, you've done tons of research and on a variety of subjects, and you have a particular interest around American, you know, history and what that means in all of its forms. And also in this book, really presenting some of the things that we don't learn about and delve into, at least in my public middle school, grade school, high school, we did not, and even in college for that matter. And so I'd like to maybe start by asking you, what prompted you to write this book and to study what you've studied and share what you've studied and shared with the world?
Yes, I think this book is in many ways a culmination of all the work I've done, you know, in the last 50 years, the scholarly work and activist work. I did my doctorate at UCLA in Los Angeles and wrote my dissertation in 1974. But there was a big break there between my being promoted to the final stage writing my dissertation and when I wrote it. Because in 1968, I quit. I quit graduate school. I pretty well quit the society as it was, along with millions of other young people at the time, including a lot of graduate students, to be a full-time activist against the war for civil rights, and being in Los Angeles and California, the farm workers movement, unionization movement of mostly Mexican workers and Filipino workers, and anti-racism. I was in a group that worked to raise consciousness about apartheid in South Africa with exiled South Africans. So I had this interest. When I first started graduate school, I wanted to do Latin American history, U.S. imperialism in Latin America. So I ended up, and so these were my studies, my exams, and seminars, and so forth. But when I went back, given, you know, all this activism, I was invited back to do my dissertation. They didn't have to invite me back, but they, the professors I had had at the time said, I was going to law school instead, and I hadn't even really thought about going back, but I realized they kind of needed me because the Civil Rights Act had just been passed, and they had real problems with having very few women. So they were going to lose federal money. I think it wasn't entirely just generous, but it did give me bargaining power. And I said, okay, but I want to choose my topic. And I laid it out to them, some work I was doing. And one reason I was going to law school was the land question in New Mexico. New Mexico and, of course, California, the whole West, what we call the Southwest and West, Texas and up to the Northwest and Colorado, Utah. This was all a part of Mexico until it was taken by the United States in a vicious, violent, deadly war, 2 years that the United States won, of course, and they took the northern half of Mexico. So the people, the indigenous people of New Mexico, the Pueblo Indians, which is what the Spanish call them, they have their own names. They were 100 city states along the Rio Grande River, the northern Rio Grande River, and irrigation farmers. And they were reduced by the Spanish invasion to 21, from 100 city states to 21. That was the level of genocide within 30 years of their entry there. So I have become very interested in the fact that the descendants of the Spanish colonizers, who, when the United States took over, were colonized by the United States and lost their land. And the Pueblos were losing their land. By then, it was Mexico when it was taken, and Mexico had ceased being imperialist there and had provided the Pueblo Indians with a legitimacy, their own land base and all. They had to fight for it, the Pueblos did, but they actually gained it. But the Spanish were, you know, the Mexicans were in power. They had most of the land still, but they lost it. So they were, in 1967, they launched an armed rebellion and took over a whole town and held it, and demanding land that they had lost back. But this is land that their ancestors had taken from the Pueblo Indians. So it was right. very complex.
Right.
And I wanted to, I had sympathy for both groups in a way, because most of these, they call themselves Hispanos to this day, were not rich people. They were poor, and they were had been deprived of the land they had. And their language, they were discriminated against because of their Spanish language and so forth. But I decided to, that's what I wanted to look in. That's what I was doing. I mainly went to law school to learn property law and to understand all of the
poverty or property.
Property law.
Understand.
Land.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Well, without it, there's poverty.
Right. It's not that they're not intertwined. Yeah.
Right. So that's, they accepted that. They were very enthusiastic about it, but it then did become a U.S. thesis rather than a Latin America, because it was within U.S. boundaries. So that sort of annoyed me, but I did get my doctorate in U.S. history. Well, at that same time that I was bargaining over that, I was at University of Santa Clara Law School in Northern California. There was a lawyer who lived in that area, who practiced law, who had been, for instance, the lawyer for Angela Davis.
Mm-hmm.
And
the great civil rights activist, for people who don't know.
Who was imprisoned, you know, falsely, and was charged with murder. So it was a very serious thing. And she was on trial during that time. And he had begun doing work with the Lakota people, Pine Ridge, because they had risen up in 1973. It was called the Wounded Knee. The Wounded Knee Uprising, where they were complaining about the tribal government being very, very oppressive. And of course, being under the Nixon administration, the American Indian Movement had formed in 1968. It was very militant, and it was making demands on the federal government. And their own tribal government was killing them, had killing squads, were killing people, and oppressing them, and having the FBI come and arrest them. So they rose up and they seized the hamlet of Wounded Knee, which historically was very important. And a book had just come out called "Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee."
Yeah.
So people, and it was a bestseller, and it also told about the Wounded Knee Massacre of 1890. So people in general in the United States knew where that was, you know, and it was, it went on for 2.5 months. There was a lot of public sympathy with the young people and elders, very traditional elders, who were carrying it out. And the Nixon administration sent the Air Force, the Army, the Marines, the FBI, every imaginable armed group of the federal government to surround them. And they still held out, amazingly. And when they negotiated to close down, and they had promised to drop charges, they broke all these promises and charged over 300 people with crimes and misdemeanors. So this lawyer was doing work with a notable Native American Dakota lawyer, Vine Deloria Jr., to build up the defense cases. And they came to my law school and they were trying to recruit, you know, law students to help out. So I, you know, I was already doing this research on for my dissertation.
Sure.
And so they recruited me. And when they told me they wanted me to be an expert witness and on the Lakotas and the Sioux Treaty and all this, I said, well, I'm not the right person because I specialize in the Southwest. I don't know anything. And Vine Deloria is very memorable to me. He had a stack of a pile of documents and books and stuff on his desk. And he picked them all up in his arms and he gave them to me. He said, I'm sure you're a quick learner.
I love
and
that.
And so I mastered this, you know, so I could be an expert witness, but it was not natural to me. I felt very, there had to be other better experts than me, you know, but there were three or four of us. And the others did know originally a lot more than I did about it, but I did learn and I became very involved in the Sioux Treaty. And that was actually my first published book was I collected all the testimony from one of the main legal things that took place, which was a motion to dismiss all these cases. And I compiled, and it was mostly the traditional elder people testifying often in Lakota in their own language and being translated. And this was in federal court in Lincoln. So my first book was The Great Sioux Nation Sitting in Judgment on America. And in 1977, it's a kind of classic book now. I edited all of the testimonies and there are also pictures of all the people testifying. And then all the time that I was doing that, I was also writing my dissertation and I turned it in 1974 and it became a book in 1980, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico. So that's really how it hadn't occurred to me before I was recruited to do this work that I would make indigenous peoples' history, the basis of my studies of history, of my academic and activist work. But that's how it came about.
Yeah, what a fascinating story. Thank you for sharing that. And I think it's so beautiful to really look at your history and oftentimes your own personal history, because we look at answering the calling, answering, you know, a lot of people, I think a lot of young people and even me, sort of what am I here to do? You know, one of my mentors, Dr. Jack Kornfield, mindfulness teacher and psychotherapist talks about his friend, Maladoma Somme, who's a shaman who talks about, you know, your job is to deliver your cargo. And so what is your cargo to deliver in this world, in this life, in this planet while we're here? And it sort of came to you in that stack of papers and here's your, you know, you're a quick learner, you know, you can figure this out. And I love that because, you know, you sort of answer the call and take to the challenge and it's not easy, but you're dedicated. And in mindfulness language, we use that sort of term called virya in Buddhist terms, which is effort and kind of discipline that we kind of stick with something and sort of see it through. Because we're really seeking, in some ways, a deeper awareness. You might want to call it some sense of enlightenment or liberation, but really you might want to just call it truth or the nature of reality. And I think that all of your work from a very specific, historically contextualized place really, really does that and gives us light and sheds light and gives us windows into all the things that we don't know, that we haven't paid attention to, or that people have literally tried to erase and disappear, whether it's genocide, land theft, residential schools in terms of culture, cultural genocide also, and the variety of ways in which indigenous folks here in what's now called the United States have been tried to be erased. So I'm just wondering, from where you sit today, I mean, there's so much that I could get into here, from the Wounded Knee battle and what that means and what the significance of that is, to the way in which you know, the Black Lives Matter movement is inextricably linked to, for example, you know, the Indigenous movement and Standing Rock and the Dakota Pipeline and even things of late that we've seen. But I'm wondering if we could kind of start at the very basis of things, which is this piece of settler colonialism and what that was about and kind of what that meant and who was involved. Because I think a lot of people have a very sort of narrow view, and I know it's complicated, too much so probably for this recording, but that, you know, there were Blacks and there were whites and there were Indigenous people, and then, you know, whatever happened and now we have America. But I think you can shed a little bit more light on what is settler colonialism, how did that work, and why is that a policy that has lasting repercussions today?
Yes, that's a good question. I also like I think that that's very fitting, the sense of a calling. I myself, growing up in growing up very poor in a rural community in Oklahoma, my father, tenant farmer, and then driving a diesel truck to farmers, my mother was a devout Southern Baptist, and they also had, you know, the evangelical, what is your calling? And I took that very seriously. And of course, by the time I was 17, I had completely gotten the Southern Baptist out of my life completely, including all Christian religion. But it stayed with me, the sense of calling. And yeah, the settler colonialism is very tied up with Christian evangelicalism as well, and in some awful ways. But I think it is, you know, it seems like a very abstract term, but it's actually historically quite precise what it is. It was first practiced in by the British in Ireland. The British conquered and colonized Ireland very early, beginning in the 16th century. But then in the a century later, they opened land. At first, they didn't take the land. They just really made the Irish peasants into, you know, workers in potato production, and which they the British exported around the world, sort of a rural proletariat. But in Northern Ireland, they created the Ulster entity, which they opened for, they drove the Irish, the indigenous Irish off the land and invited Scots and Anglos to settle there. So they, some of them were poor, some of them were rich, some of them were barons, but they came to outpopulate the indigenous Catholic Irish, and of course oppress them in new ways on a very personal basis, not just the you know, the British military, which is bad enough, but just day-to-day life. And of course that situation still exists today, you know, Ulster, Northern Ireland, is still there to, you know, look at and study settler colonialism. But that practice and those very settlers, the Scots-Irish, of which my father's family, I'm descended on my father's side from these Scots-Irish settlers, they actually came from Ulster, from that experience with the British, to settle the colonies, particularly in the South. Brought settler colonialism, you know, the practices with them. And mainly it's a, you know, this settler colonialism is people come to stay and to take the land and to get rid of the inhabitants and take their land. It's different from later immigrants who come to an already organized polity, and they may come to stay, but they're somewhat contingent and not necessarily then, you know, in the seat of power like a settler is. So you have white settler democracy actually developing that formed the United, what became the United States. So I think,
and roughly what time are we talking about now? This is what time frame?
Well, it started, you know, in 1607 with the Virginia colony, driving out the settlers, driving out the indigenous people. First of all, you know, leeching off them, of them. They didn't bring enough supplies to sustain themselves, so they took the Indians. They did bring plenty of military people with them, and they took the gardens, they took the farms. These were, you know, very intensive farmers, subsistence farmers. And one of the products that they grew that was unique to North America was tobacco. And they used it as a both as a sacrament and for ritual, because they knew it was a powerful and harmful substance if it was, you know, treated. But what, you know, they, because they had fields of tobacco, the settlers decided that this was, well, first of all, they got addicted to it and realized it, you know, it, I always say the United States started as the drug trade, you know, that they then found when they shipped that, others got addicted to it in Europe, and it became very popular, and it just sold like gold. You know, they came for gold and they found tobacco, they found drugs.
Right.
So that that is not, you know, that is a questionable beginning of what became the United States, and has
one of many.
It has remained a kind of through point, you know, like drug trades everywhere they invade in the world. You know, they create drug trades and drug addiction. But I wanted, you know, when they decided to split with Britain, this was really in 1750s and 60s, when the British and the French fought in a vicious war in Europe. It was called the Seven Years' War. And they also fought because the French had fur trading territory. They weren't really doing settler colonialism. They were mainly men, mainly fur traders, although, you know, Native people got caught up in it and were colonized in some ways, but it wasn't settler colonialism. They still had their villages. They still had, it just introduced, you know, a lot of trade items and dependency. But they had this huge war, and the British won. So they won all this French territory, which was over the edge of the Appalachian mountains. That was all then British territory. And the settlers, by then there were 13 colonies, and they all wanted, they had already been going over the line, you know, into the area that was forbidden because it was French territory. Now it was British territory, so they started pouring over, and the British did a proclamation that drew a line at the Appalachian and Allegheny Mountains, prohibiting any settlement. It was very densely populated with Native villages. And they had, you know, after a century and a half, learned very well how to fight. They had been pushed out. There, many of them were peoples who had been pushed out of the Atlantic, you know, Atlantic shore colonies, and so they had built up a huge resistance to any further incursion on their territories. It's called the Northwest Territory, and of course that didn't refer to Washington and Oregon. It referred to Ohio, what's now Ohio, Kentucky, Illinois, Indiana, that whole area. So they brought redcoats. They imposed taxes and penalties for anyone going in there. They required the colonists to give boarding, you know, to allow soldiers, redcoats, to stay with them for housing. So you find all these things in the Declaration of Independence. You don't know what they're talking about exactly, you know, what they're referring to, if you don't know the history, and almost no one ever bothers to know the real history of the United States. But all those things are iterated, why they are declaring independence. And all of it is about that prohibition. That is why they split. It had nothing to, their freedom they talked about was the freedom to kill Indians and take their land. And the British were colonists. They weren't protecting the Indians. They were protecting their empire, which was, you know, they knew that they couldn't mount enough troops to conquer the Indians. Plus there was nothing in it for them. But for the settlers, They had already developed land sales with illegitimate real estate deals, because they had gone in and mapped. George Washington was the biggest and made his great wealth off land speculation before independence. By the time he's 22, he had made a fortune off going in and mapping. We always, you know, he's always portrayed as a surveyor. Well, he would take in, you know, the militia and map all these areas over the mountain range and then sell that land to landless settlers. And he didn't own it. So in order to you know, his great wealth was at risk if they didn't become independent, because the British didn't recognize these land sales. So this was the reason they split. And they developed in the Northwest Ordinance before the Constitution, that became a part of the Constitution. And this Northwest Ordinance was a way of measuring land for land sales, because land sales is really, the United States was founded as a corporation, as a, you know, capitalist state, and land was the capital. Land sales was the capital.
Yeah,
and including settlers to settle it.
I just want to underscore that, because I really feel as though it's important to kind of emphasize and underscore that, again, from a mindfulness perspective, we talk about the things that are what we call at the root of suffering. And one is greed, the other one is aversion, and the other one is ignorance. And that, you know, this idea of sort of greed is sort of, I think, at the root of sort of taking what's not yours and to excess, and sort of what you're talking about is this was woven into the way in which the very seed that was planted here, not what was pre-existing with 100 million indigenous folks down to 10 million, not what was here, what would what was arrived, but what was turned into property, what was otherwise an interdependent, all my relations, connectedness. I'm a human being, but there are birds, there are fish, there are trees, there are these other things, and we are all interrelated and interdependent on this land. That was turned into a commodity.
Yes, that's right. The Native people, land was something that was alive, that was the land, the animals, the trees, all the resources were living beings and relations. You know, when they say all my relations, they mean all the land, all the resources in the land, and all the animals. And they know that they are, that human beings are, for survival, are dependent on each other, and they build many different kinds of societies, but they all have it in common, this mutuality and a respect for the land. And I found with the Pueblo Indians when I was researching that it seemed a great mystery to others that had studied it, why they moved from the huge civilization they had built, the Mesa Verde, that was had, you know, irrigation works that were 22 feet in diameter, that waterproof, was a huge civilization. And they explain it in their oral tradition that all of this took wood, you know, it took, everything was built from the wood and rocks, but that they had denuded the wood. They had used up the resources. So they learned from that. They moved to the Rio Grande Valley, transferred, and they downsized to smaller city states, smaller irrigation, and, you know, a different kind of life, because they had no capital investment in it. You know, it was hurting them. It was hurting human beings, what they had done. And they learned from that and changed it. The other thing that, you know, the Spanish just found abhorrent is when, the Americas were not disease-free, as people say. You know, they make that claim in order to say that they were not, there was no immunity, and, you know, and Indians just dropped dead of disease. They only dropped dead of disease when they were in crowded refugee camps and starving, you know, when an invasion. These were almost all any kind of starving and dying of disease was related to war being made upon them. But they built these, most people have seen pictures of Taos Pueblo and Acoma and these these really substantial multi-story buildings that if they had, you know, before the Europeans came, they had a something similar to bubonic plague, because that is very common with irrigation societies to have that, you know, that virus. And when one person would come down with the plague, they would burn their entire village, burn it to the ground. They would quarantine that person, and they would move and build a whole new city. That's what, you know, wow. With this pandemic, this is the kind of thing we need to think in those terms for survival, because they knew it spread, you know. I mean, right. It was very obvious. They probably had experiences before that, you know, where it did spread. And maybe even at Mesa Verde, they had some kind of catastrophe like that. So these are things that capitalism won't allow, you know, allow human-centered survival as the number one priority. And that is its absolutely worst, deadly aspect. But let me read you a excerpt from a book on the Northwest Ordinance and settler colonialism, how capitalistic and totally rationalized settler colonialism was as a something to implement. So in the Northwest Ordinance, its importance was equal to that of the Constitution. It's little known, but it's actually the basis of the Constitution. It didn't deal with ethereal concepts of pursuit of happiness, but instead declared in practical terms how the land from the Appalachian Mountains up to the Mississippi River was to be conquered. And this was done by surveyors' chains, each 22 yards in length. The measuring began at an arbitrary point in the Ohio Territory, and invisible lines were drawn on the land to form a grid of perfect rectangles marked by iron bars and the occasional brass plate cemented onto a masonry base. Each of the rectangles had its own map reference. And as the U.S. Imperium expanded, the grid eventually reached the Pacific coast and stretched between Mexico and British North America. The lines on the land not only conquered natural topography, but also made possible the liberation of parcels of land from their previous occupants and their efficient allocation of newcomers. So this was very thought out, you know, and they paid no attention to rivers or mountains or trees or anything else in developing these saleable plots of land that could be made into pieces of paper that could be sold and became the basis of the stock market as well.
Yeah, wow. That is such an incredible history. And thank you so much for sharing that. Because I think that, you know, settler colonialism has been likened to chattel slavery, which is, of course, the system that the transatlantic slave trade, you know, perpetuated and has the policies, the legacy of the policies that were legalized and enforced for years. You know, we're dealing with the inheritance of all of that also. And as a therapist, as a somatic psychotherapist, my sort of interest is not only dealing with the individual, but also in the cultural trauma and the intergenerational and the historical trauma that lives not only in bodies, but in our land. And we see global climate change, I see as the big culturally, you know, earth mother somatic disruption also, which, you know, the stewards of the land, Homo sapiens, as we might be, have not maybe really kept our contract in pursuit of what you're talking about, this wealth accumulation, wealth in a way that there's only so much extraction one can do before it, you know, things are depleted, as we're seeing with certain, you know, natural fossil fuels and things like that. I want to maybe touch on a couple of other things. We have about 15 or 20 minutes left here. You mentioned that there were different points, and I don't know which ones you want to talk about, but you mentioned the evangelical thing a little bit earlier, and Christianity and the doctrine of discovery and sort of the going way back to the 1400s really sort of set the stage for some of what this go forth and conquer and, you know, you're entitled to sort of take and accumulate, sort of set the stage for that, whether it was enslavement or whether it was land theft or whatnot. And from that and the accumulation of wealth for some at the expense of others, there were some movements made to have multiracial or multi-ethnic, it really wasn't even race, I don't think at the time, multi-ethnic or diverse coalitions, like you say, the Green Corn Rebellion, multi-ethnic resistance, that there were times when people came together and were sort of united in oppression around wealth and poverty and discrimination, and not around race or ethnicity. It was more of a class coalitions, and that sort of this idea of race and genocide was used to keep that from gaining ground. And I guess I'm just a little bit curious. You know, you mentioned Wounded Knee, and of course there are whole narratives around American culture that have been spun up from John Wayne and the Lone Ranger and Tonto and all of these things, and even Mount Rushmore, where we look at about what America is and what it isn't. And here you are, having written this incredible book, Dr. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. That's who we're talking with today. What do you think is the most important things for us to know now in terms of where we are in 2021, given the politics that we are living through, given the climate crisis, given the racial pandemic, the COVID pandemic, and all of that? What can people learn now from what they don't know that you could share the nuggets that you know?
well, I think you brought up, of course, the parallel of chattel slavery and settler colonialism. They're completely interrelated, and I think on one level, you know, Native people see the land as a body, as if it's, you know, a body just as the human body is.
Right.
It can be injured, it can be hurt, it can die unnaturally, or die naturally. Some die naturally. But the slave body, what gets left out too often of chattel slavery, I mean, everyone knows about the auction block and sales, but I think they don't really understand that profoundly what it means to turn the human body into collateral, into a commodity to be bought and sold on the stock market. Native people saw land, and then I think Africans in Africa before, you know, they were slaves, also see land as a body, you know, as a living thing that can't be bought and sold.
Right.
But you think of the human body being a commodity, not simply a factor of labor. That's bad enough. You know, exploited labor, and often indentured servitude, or trafficking people for labor, you know, migrant workers and all, is called slavery. And it shouldn't be, because slavery should be reserved for chattel slavery, that it is the body that is a collateral, and like the land. So there's that parallel, and the removal of the stewards of that land in the South that became the Cotton Kingdom and the basis of U.S. capitalism, that in which they bred African bodies in Virginia. They no longer did the international slave trade legally. They bred bodies to be transported to work in that land that had been taken and defiled by a monocrop cotton. And this injury, you know, it is, you mentioned intergenerational trauma. It's tied up in so many ways. Of course, for every succeeding person, you know, and a former enslaved peoples, and also of Native peoples, but also of the settlers.
Yes.
As the having, the need to come to, I think there's this desire. I saw it with the protests, you know, the Black Lives Matter. I think even Black Lives Matter were somewhat taken aback and surprised by the overwhelming response of people in places like Oklahoma, where I come from, that, you know, go out and protest, least of all against racism, and in Idaho and Wyoming, and, you know, all these places that people do not want that poison inside themselves. They don't want that toxin, but they don't know how to get rid of it. Yeah. You know, it is constantly encouraged, like you say, to keep people apart and to weaken anything we can bring forward. It's going to have to be millions and millions and millions of people from, you know, all peoples. And it's going to have to include the white population acting in a, you know, not guilt-stricken. I did feel that in the response that was coming last summer, that it wasn't just the same old guilt-stricken thing, you know, liberals being guilt-stricken. I think that's better than nothing, frankly. I think being guilt-stricken isn't horrible because there's a lot of guilt to be had there. I mean, but it's not very productive, you know, as sustaining.
Sure.
It doesn't necessarily lead to, it can be paralyzing rather than leading to action.
I agree.
But I think people were getting it. And a lot of that has, I mean, some people have, you know, kind of fallen off of that, but I think a very substantial number of people moved forward in that sense. And I think it's even tied to the January 6th invasion of the Capitol, that these white nationalists really got spooked by all that, you know, that they're going to lose their, you know, that they must have had a sense of, well, during the thing, they were constantly harassing and even killing the protesters, these white nationalists were, but they must be freaking out. You know, this is, things are going to change in a way that will not, that white settlers are trained to be.
Yeah, I think, you know, what you're pointing to, I think, is just the reality around our inheritance. And I think that, you know, a lot of the folks who've been on this podcast before have talked about the different things around the invention of whiteness and how it's very, very specifically, you know, a creation and a construct that's used to divide versus unite. And the reasons why, you know, it's sort of taken hold is it's sort of this idea of access to power, proximate opportunity, even if not real opportunity. And I guess, you know, sort of, you know, in the last, I'm sorry.
I disagreed. I agree.
You disagree.
No, I agree with you.
Oh, you agree. Okay. I want to make sure we're on the same page. And so just in maybe the last 5 minutes or so, you know, I think there's so much that we could say, and we've said a lot. I really do encourage people to read the book or to listen to it if it's on audio tape, the Indigenous People's History of the United States with Dr. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, to really get a sense of what the inheritance is and to not get caught in what I call a shame spiral, as you say, guilt, but to use it as an opportunity for compassionate connection, and that the sense of moral injury that we may have, that's sort of like this existential cloud around us that some of us may feel, could be used, as the Dalai Lama might say, a force for good, moving toward compassionate action of connection. And I'm wondering what you think people can do today, if anything. Would you encourage people to study, to learn?
learn? Would you encourage them to sort of look inside and do more of an internal investigation around their own relationship with land? Would you encourage them to maybe learn more about Indigenous communities that may be near and sort of find out what their needs are? What do you feel is a good place for anyone listening to this podcast to begin if they were interested in waking up more to what a true ally, if you would be, to an Indigenous person in the United States now might be? What would that look like?
Well, kind of all of the above, but I do think, as a historian, I do think that that people need to, I think they know it kind of under, you know, unconsciously, but it has to be brought to consciousness and acknowledged that the U.S. is a colonial state, and to drop all of the one wonderful piece in the New York Review of Books or somewhere about the July 6th and how people have to come to terms, all the things I would say, you know, they had to come to terms with history and who we are. You know, people are saying this isn't who we are. This was arguing, well, yes, it is who we are, and we have to face that. But then it says, if we are to fulfill, it ends with, if we are to fulfill the vision and the work of the founders, we have to learn these things. And I said, they're the ones that inscribed it. The founders are the very people, the slave owners and Indian killers, who set the whole thing up and inscribed it in our brains, and it's repeated and worshiped and made holy every day, and, you know, every politician, everything that comes out of their mouth. So this is, you know, my heart fell because I thought, what kind of, you know, what kind of warped thinking would lead a person, an intelligent person, to make that important argument about history and then say the founding fathers were perfect? You know, that's a cult. That is a cult. We live in a cult, the cult of the Constitution. That's what I call one of the chapters, you know.
Right.
And go into that. And it goes back to the, you know, the Puritans and the Magna Carta and the that culty thing we have, and it reproduces cults, the QAnon, the, you know, cult after cult after cult. So we have to deprogram our cultish connection to the Constitution and to the so-called founders, you know, who designed this horrible system that we have propagated. I thank you, Francesca.
Yes, I was just going to say, I thank you, Dr. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. You can find it at a bookshop and your local bookstores. And I just really want to express my sincere gratitude for your decades of scholarship and activism and your presence here today on the Rerooted podcast.
And by the way, I'm sitting here on Ohlone Nation land, unceded.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
And reawakening their civilization.
Yes.
Thank you, Francesca.
Thank you, Dr. Dunbar-Ortiz. Take good care.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.